are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, December 13th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Stephen A. Cook, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're talking about MBS, the larger structural problems in the U.S.-Saudi relationship. Also, Turkey, as Erdogan threatens more military action against the Kurds. Is it really time to finally reassess the U.S.-Turkish relationship? All that and more with Stephen Cook. Hush money inquiry adds to Trump's dangers as the National Enquirer flips. Michael Cohen gets hit with three. And the next phase, the Mueller probe, it's looking at the Middle East, which might be even more fruitful territory for essentially what could be a vast, wide-ranging investigation into global corruption and oligarchy, which would implicate the entire political order if it was done right. Senate to vote on aid to the Yemen war as Bernie Sanders pushes forward. Meanwhile, in the House, five despicable, grotesque Democrats join Paul Ryan in a vote to murder and slaughter more Yemenis, blood on hands all around. North Carolina legislature calls for a new primary if a new election is held in the disputed district after extreme Republican funny business there, as Democrat, or I should say coup business, just as in Wisconsin and Michigan, Republicans racing forward to limit democracy after losing elections there. Nancy Pelosi strikes deal on leadership term limits in return for new votes to become Speaker. Cottoned to demand new efforts on a criminal justice overhaul bill. But of course, the devil is in the details. Theresa May survives a no-confidence vote, although Margaret Thatcher resigned with an even more generous margin than May got. She is symbolically leading the country, and her Brexit deal is a non-starter, as Jeremy Corbyn calls.
You seem to be a bit of a glum bucket.
As Jeremy Corbyn calls for elections, AMLO begins his fight to restore democracy and combat neoliberalism in Mexico. Two leaders of Brazil's landless people's movement, landless rural workers movement, were assassinated in a machine gun attack at one of their camps over the weekend. As Lula says, he will not trade his dignity for freedom. And the same political prosecutor who put Lula in jail, now Bolsonaro's justice minister, promises to attack labor unions in his next phase of quote-unquote anti-corruption politics. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. What's up, fellas?
Hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
So there was a vote, basically a parliamentary maneuver in the House that Paul Ryan put into play to essentially attach a motion to bring forward a bill that Ro Khanna is sponsoring in the House. It's a parallel to what Bernie Sanders, Chris Murphy, and Mike Lee are working on in the Senate to halt U.S. funding, refueling, and really active participation efforts in the Saudi Arabian United Arab Emirates war on Yemen. It's killed tens of thousands of people. It's caused a cholera outbreak, food shortages. It's targeted schools, hospitals, funeral homes. It is one of the most savage, sustained, and brutal crimes occurring on a daily basis in the world today, with full active United States and U.S. and U.K. participation in this calumny led by the Saudi regime. Paul Ryan very much has that same blood on his hands, has that same Yemeni blood in his beard. And that maneuver, which as I understand it was a parliamentary maneuver to attach the motion to proceed with the vote on defunding the war on Yemen, was attached to an agriculture bill, which meant that basically the agriculture bill being voted on and moving forward would delay a vote on the Khanna bill until the new year. So 18 Republicans crossed party lines to vote for it. 5 Democrats crossed party lines to vote against it. We'll talk about those 5 in a minute. But first, this is Ro Khanna on the floor of the House yesterday explaining the maneuvers that are going to lead to even more bloodshed in Yemen. Thank you to Paul Ryan's disgusting leadership.
Americans around this country are wondering, what does a farm bill have to do with the war in Yemen? And the answer is absolutely nothing. You wonder why people are frustrated with Congress, why they think Congress lacks common sense. It's because no one understands why you would have a vote on a farm bill and you would tie it to a vote on war and peace in Yemen. The only reason the leadership is doing this is because they know that there are dozens of Republicans who will stand with Democrats to stop the killing in Yemen. How do they know this? Because Senate Republicans are voting to stop the killing in Yemen. I came to Congress because of my grandfather, who inspired me, who spent 4 years in jail in Gandhi's independence movement. And I came to Congress to say that America should always stand for human rights. I urge my Republican colleagues, look at the pictures in the New York Times and Huffington Post. 5-year-old kids, 7-year-old kids starving to death. A Yemeni's child dying every 10 minutes. They tell us to wait till January. That would mean thousands of more Yemeni's kids dead. I don't think this is a partisan issue. This is an American issue. Let's stop the killing in Yemen. Let's end the famine. Let's have a vote in this House so we can stop the civil war in Yemen and save lives.
I'm going to quote now briefly from a great piece in Splinter. 5 Democrats joined Paul Ryan to vote for more Yemeni blood on their hands is the correct title of the piece. House Speaker Paul Ryan, because he's a ghoul, doesn't support ending the war on Yemen. Ryan also selects the 9 majority members of the House Rules Committee, which gets to set rules under which a bill will be voted on. On Tuesday night, House Rules Committee stuck in a small part to the rules for the farm bill, which again was expecting to pass and now has passed and has nothing to do with Yemen, that blocked the House from voting on a Yemen resolution sponsored by Democrat Ro Khanna. That rule change went to a vote Wednesday afternoon and immediately caused a stir. Over a dozen Republicans flipped to no votes right away, and several more followed, but ultimately 5 Democrats handed this one to Ryan. Who are these 5 despicable, obscene, disgusting, need to be immediately primary Democrats? They are Jim Costa, Al Lawson, Colin Peterson, Dutch Ruppersberger, and David Scott. We're going to talk more about the Bloody 5 who need to be primaried, who need to have their offices called, who need to have letters sent to them, who need to be tweeted at, who need to be shamed and protested in every forum. But just to give you a flavor of the Bloody 5 who voted for Yemen genocide, here's Representative Colin Peterson. He's a Democrat. I don't know what state. We're going to get these guys' states soon.
Minnesota.
He's Representative Colin Peterson, Democrat from Minnesota, explaining why he sided with the Republican majority and Paul Ryan on continuing to murder Yemenis. He said, quote, "Our party gets off on tangents," which is how he's deeming cholera, famine, the murder of tens of thousands of people with U.S. support and weapons. This is Jeff Stein's full exchange with him. Jeff Stein from
Vox.
You
can read Jeff Stein. I'll read Peterson.
Okay. Can you explain your vote on the Yemen resolution?
Yeah, it didn't belong in there.
Why not? Couldn't you have just come back and done another vote?
No, we've worked for 2 years on this farm bill, and I'll be damned if I let anybody screw it up.
Do you have any thoughts about the war in Yemen?
I don't know a damn thing about it, and it should be in there, and it didn't do anything anyway.
What do you mean by that?
All it did was say they couldn't have a vote or something. Didn't authorize anything. It didn't, you know, our party gets off on tangents. It's ridiculous.
So, we basically know why Colin Peterson voted for Yemen genocide, because he is literally a absolute, addition to being callous and immoral, obviously a complete airhead who is totally, no one with this level of total moral failing plus complete intellectual inability should be serving in Congress. And I know that there's plenty of people with no moral ability and total intellectual shortcomings who serve in Congress, but we should still have higher standards. And Colin Peterson is an immoral airhead, and that explains his vote for the enjoining the Yemen Genocide Caucus and the leadership of Paul Ryan.
And I'm pretty sure all these five, or a good chunk of them, are in pretty safe Democrat seats.
These are safe Democrat seats. They all need to be primaried. I actually want to give a shout out. I believe it was Tommy Vitor, who is a PodSave guy. I don't it in the packet. He tweeted out last night, "Are you interested in primarying any of the five?
Get
in touch with me." Excellent.
Well done, Tommy.
Well done, Tommy. Great stuff. Okay. Let's talk briefly about who's bringing today's show, and then we will get Stephen A. Cook. 2018 has been a very difficult year for human rights, as you just witnessed there, among many other examples. But have you ever wondered how rights abuses are documented around the world? You probably have, with the sheer number of global crises we're seeing, from civilian casualties in Syria to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar to the caging of children on the U.S. border. It's critical that we expose the truth in order to defend the rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. Human Rights Watch does just that. We are an independent nonprofit organization. They are an independent nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy, often in partnership with local activists and human rights groups. They accept no money from any government, but rely on the support of informed, dedicated people just like you. So if human rights are important to you, visit hrw.org/majority to make a donation and support its vital work around the world. When you do, not only is your gift tax deductible, it will be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. That means your donation will go twice as far to advance justice and defend the basic dignity of people who need it most. Again, that's hrw.org/majority. Casper is the sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products and create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience. One night at a time. With three mattress models, the Casper Original, the Wave, and the Essential, Casper mattresses are perfectly designed to cradle and soothe your natural geometry. Not to mention, the breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulate your body temperature throughout the night. And it's delivered right to your door in a small how-do-they-do-that size box with free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. But the best part is that you can be sure your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep on a trial. After all, you spend a third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable. Now, I got my first Casper about 3 weeks ago. I'm definitely not going to be sending it back. It's an incredibly comfortable sleeping experience. The box comes to your door. It is incredibly convenient. You can just carry it yourself upstairs. Then you open up the box and it literally sort of unfolds out like that into a full, incredible, comfortable mattress. I'm sleeping really, really well on it, and I'm thrilled that I got it. Get $50 towards a select mattress by visiting casper.com/majority and using majority at checkout. That's casper.com/majority. Offer code MAJORITY for 50 off of your mattress purchase. Terms and conditions apply. We were going to take a brief break, and we'll be back with Stephen A. Cook from the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome back, Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Stephen A. Cook. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Steve, thanks a million for doing this. How are you doing?
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure, Michael. Great to be on with you as always.
As always, my friend. We're going to do as we're wont to do, a sort of broader regional tour of MENA. We're going
to
touch specifically on Saudi Arabia and well, that's the region you picked, my friend.
Right.
I didn't force your hand. As a, you know, you could have been doing much more fun things as an undergraduate, I'm sure. I studied a lot of it too.
This was fun.
Right. Was it fun getting a PhD?
It was, actually. It was a lot of fun. It was a blast. I mean, people struggle through it, and I had my moments. But, of course, you know, getting the opportunity to go and kind of live abroad for a period of time and delve into intellectual questions that fascinate you, what could be bad, right?
Well, I guess until, you know, Donald Trump is president, Erdogan's president, MBS runs the Saudi monarchy, LCC is in Egypt, Netanyahu's in Israel. I don't know. I'm ticking the boxes here.
In one sense, that is interesting. In another sense, it's deeply and profoundly depressing, which is why I said, do we really have to? But let's go. Let's talk about it all.
Well, as people will know from listening to your, I don't know if you want me to plug this, but I listen to the Amen Quarter podcast that you do with our friend Brad. And people know that actually Steve is quite capable of talking about a lot more than MENA.
This is true. Thanks for plugging me on Men Corner. It's a lot of fun to do with our buddy Brad Rothschild. We go a little less on the Middle East politics and more on the just general politics and pop culture stuff.
That's the like, hey, why aren't there bands like The Clash or Public Enemy anymore? What happened? The Gefilte Fish at Zabar's isn't as good anymore. And my God, is Ted Cruz an asshole?
There you go.
It's a great show.
Thanks, buddy.
Oh, no, for real. I want to talk. I mean, we did the opening segment on the House's just this unbelievable moral failure to pass the Rokana bill to stop funding the Saudi-UAE war on Yemen, which, I mean, you know, we could keep spelling out, is really one of the greatest, you know, humanitarian abuses and crises in the world today. Paul Ryan stuck it into a farm bill in this incredibly cynical parliamentary maneuver. 18 Republicans actually crossed sides to vote the right way, and 5 Democrats crossed sides to vote the wrong way. And then, of course, there's the Sanders-Murphy-Lee bill in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I mean, we'll get to Khashoggi soon, but I mean, there is the sort of, I mean, there's all the terrifying implications of the Khashoggi murder, but there is, I think, the very fair point that, you know, this has been going on since 2015 with U.S. support, and it's an undeniable just sort of mass crime against humanity. You know, in spite of the setback, I mean, is the politics of it shifting in D.C. with a kind of broader frustration, even disgust with Saudi Arabia?
I'd like to say that it is, but I'm not convinced that it will be.
Yeah.
I think, look, there's tremendous amount of moral outrage over Khashoggi murder, which has in turn focused more people's attention on Yemen. But as you quite rightly point out, where were people in 2015? Quite honestly, where were people in 2006 when this cataclysm really began? So, you know, the Saudis have only been there for 3 years or so, but it's been going on for quite some time. And we have, as you point out, been supporting it. I think the Obama administration took a look at this and said, well, we are negotiating with the Iranians, and this has freaked out our allies in the Gulf. So what can we do to reassure them that we're on their side in helping to ensure their security? And of course, we picked Yemen. Right. Yemen. This is craziness. An argument can be made that you have to have a robust approach to Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen, which is, you know, deeply embedded in that country and a threat. But to enable the Saudis in their kind of ill-fated intervention, which at the outset of it, when they said what they were fighting for, and they basically said this, that they were fighting to prevent the Hezbollahization of Yemen and to ensure that the Iranians didn't get a toehold in the Arabian Peninsula. And you looked at what they were doing and said, well, this is all going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy that you're never going to be able to get out of. And of course, that's what's come to pass. And in the crossbar have been millions of Yemenis who are on the verge of starvation. There's cholera. It's terrible. And then, of course, so that was the Obama administration, long wind up the Obama administration's thing on. And then the Trump administration comes into office and who have this kind of, you know, single-minded focus on confronting the Iranians, and that the focal point of their policy is going to be Saudi Arabia. And in particular, they're going to put Jared Kushner in charge of handling the relationship with Saudi Arabia because he's a 30-something, and so is the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. It's just bizarre in the extreme that only has made things worse. Because of what it did, it signaled to the Saudis that they can get around the formal foreign policy process, go directly to the son-in-law, go directly to the president, who really doesn't know much about anything, as we all know. I mean, just but the level of the president's ignorance upon coming to office is actually greater than many people suspect. So this is how we got there.
So do you think, and I want to just do a real, you know, realist, no sort of, you know, moral judgment about the Houthis one way or another, but it does strike me that even just, okay, that the Saudi foreign policy of assuming that the Houthis are just a sort of replicate, a Yemeni Hezbollah, you said Hezbollahization, and you know, Hezbollah is an organic group to Lebanon, but it's definitely, it's I don't know if it's exactly an Iranian proxy, but the power and capacity of Hezbollah is dependent and reciprocal to the Iranian government. And so that is maybe fair to look at Hezbollah and say you can't understand Hezbollah without understanding the Islamic Republic. And the Houthis, okay, in my read, are a far more, yes, they're Shia, but they are an organic group to Yemen, whatever you think of them one way or another. And yes, they've taken some support from Iran, sure, but plenty of groups take, you know, plenty of support from various state actors. It doesn't mean that they are a creation of them. And it seems, right, so I guess, would you explain the Houthis on that axis of like organic to a place versus a proxy?
So the Saudis have been in conflict with this group that we now refer to as the Houthis for decades. Going back to, the 1930s. The Houthis are actually named after a guy named Hussein al-Houthi, who raised this militia and that was based around the solidarity of a sect of Shiism called, they are what's called Zaydis. They are Shia, but they don't believe the same things that the Iranian Shia. They're not 12 or Shia. Not necessary to get into all the details of this, but so this has been a conflict that's been ongoing. Of course, the Saudis supported them during a previous Yemeni civil war in the 1960s, but it has been a conflictual relationship. Hussein al-Houthi had, a variety of worldviews that we would find to be, unpleasant. He was a 9/11 truther. He took up the Iranian Revolutionary Creed, death to America, death to the Jews, victory for Islam. But the worldview is sort of a mishmash of kind of Islamic State, things that are kind of indigenous to Houthi thinking. But the conflict in Yemen began as a conflict between the Houthis and the central government. That was also a long running conflict. The Saudis, from their perspective, the gains that the Houthi militia, now Houthi army, made in forcing the legitimate government, not necessarily popular, but legitimate government out of Sana'a, was to them, how could the Houthis possibly do this? There must be an Iranian hand in it. And that's, much of what the Saudis see around them, they perceive to be an Iranian hand at work. But you're spot on. This is a group that is indigenous. Their conflicts within Yemen are local conflicts. And when the Saudis threw their forces into Yemen in 2015, they had done it actually once before in 2009, committed ground troops and kind of got their butts handed to them and they retreated. So now it's just been primarily an air campaign. The Iranians used the opportunity to support the Houthis. So if you look at it really from a geopolitical perspective, here you have the Saudis who are spending millions and millions and billions and millions of dollars on this quagmire. And the Iranians need to spend very, very little, and the Houthis only really have to fight the Saudis to a standstill to win. And that's precisely what's happened. And they have driven the Houthis closer to the Iranians, but that's right. Not the way it started, and that's not the way it had to be.
Right. So we're going to get to MBS in a second, but I do just want to touch. So the other dynamic here about Yemen, so it's one thing to say, yes, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and the presence in Yemen was, absolutely real. And definitely, I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty skeptical, I have to say, mostly of sort of like the capacity of these groups to steadily and consistently threaten the United States in terms of on the U.S. homeland in any type of systemic way. But there's no doubt that whether it's even as an example, the attacks that Al-Qaeda started with in the late 90s, like embassy mm-hmm. attacks,
embassy like, bombing,
right? Like
the
those
coal,
are the coal. The those are very serious, very harmful terrorist attacks that sort of initially gave them their legs. It's one thing to recognize that it's a real threat and a real operative organization, and also, but it does not mean obviously that we endorse the drone policy there, which was very destructive to Yemen.
Right.
So what's the dynamic between, on one hand, you have this sort of weird dual approach where on one hand, okay, there's an actual problem there, but let's just outsource it to drone warfare, which kills a lot of civilians and causes instability. I think that's been very documented, including even by military sources. I don't think this is a controversial opinion at all at this point. And then conversely to say, oh, the real issue is the Saudi UAE perception of Yemen, and that's all about Iran. And we certainly know how the Saudis can be quite willing to support, rather right-wing Salafist groups in their proxy war. So how does the U.S. – I mean, both approaches are pretty disastrous, but how does that
right.
square get circled here?
Well, and this is really, in Yemen, you have a number of different conflicts that are all going on at one time.
Right.
And what really focused the American attention on Yemen was, in fact, the underwear bomber. The underwear bomber was the guy who came, you know, he was sent by AQAP. The intention was to blow up a flight en route to Detroit on Christmas Day. And I can't even remember the year we've been at this.
Was it 2009?
I feel like it was 2000 and sometime between 2006 and 2009. I cannot remember. Maybe 2006 was the guy with the shoe bomber guy.
Yeah.
Regardless, it was really that threat. And people sort of woke up to the fact that, although the United States had dealt this extraordinary blow to Al-Qaeda Central in Afghanistan, that there were these kind of affiliate organizations essentially out there operating on their own, and that Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula was a particularly potent one, and that it certainly had the means to try to put on these spectacular attacks. And I think that's what the drone warfare began. And then, of course, the Obama administration really ramped it up. It was a way of Obama proving that he was going to be tough in regard to American security, but without having to deploy American forces all over the world, which was, you know, the theory of his 2008 run for office. We're not going to do stupid stuff, but I think his quote was, "I won't be afraid to pull the trigger."
Right.
So you've got that. And then the Emiratis are interesting because, in fact, their primary focus in Yemen had been AQAP. They saw AQAP, Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, as a significant threat to them. And they were kind of in these hit-and-run type military operations against AQAP, sometimes in cooperation with the United States, sometimes on their own. And then the Saudis launched into Yemen, and the Emiratis actually got really nervous, believing that the Saudis wouldn't win and that it would destabilize the Arabian Peninsula. So they decided they needed to support the Saudis there. But they do that primarily through their own Yemeni proxies. And of course, there are conflicts between these different groups and AQAP as well as ISIS. So one can imagine, in some weird way, there is actually, Houthis don't like ISIS. The United States doesn't like ISIS. No one likes ISIS. But, of course, the Iranian issue overrides everything for the Saudis. And it's very, very important for the Emiratis. And as the junior partner to the Saudis, they want to be supportive of the Saudis.
And I just always like to mention, I was obviously big critic of Obama's drone policy and just the sort of structure of drone policy in general. But for those who would draw false equivalencies, drone strikes have actually up-tempoed under Trump, and there's clearly, any type of systemic analysis to try to minimize civilian casualties is totally out the window in the Trump era.
From the very beginning, from the first weeks of the Trump presidency, he basically said, "I'm unleashing the military to do whatever it is that they want to do." At least in the Obama administration, there was, you wanted to do these things, it had to go all the way up to the White House for them to get the go-ahead to undertake some of these drone strikes.
Right. That's just really important to underline, I think, and in a way that justifies neither but makes very clear legal and moral distinctions. So MBS I found
where
it,
do we begin?
Yeah, I always thought this whole branding of MBS was ludicrous. Watching him get a Starbucks with Mike Bloomberg was one of the more, it's like a Venn diagram of almost everything I don't like in politics. So how easy was it in a way that is very not compliment? Let me frame it this way. There's obviously major, major human rights issues in Saudi Arabia, and most people are aware of them. Everything from, the more sort of, executing Shia civil rights activists. People have no connection to any kind of violence, but have merely spoken out around, sort of civil space to the extent that exists in Saudi Arabia, to, of course, very extreme forms of gender segregation. It seemed
gender apartheid.
Gender apartheid, 100%. Thank you. Gender apartheid. It seemed to me, and correct me if I'm being too cynical here, that one of the reasons that MBS was able to get so much currency was because he was playing on a very narcissistic conversation in the United States, which is that we would swoop in and find these extreme examples, all of which were true, but not do any systemic analysis around them. So, oh my God, can you believe women can't drive there? Well, that's obviously appalling, and there's no, and that's not because of Islam or anything. That's a human rights abuse. You know, that's a decision made right. in a Saudi context. And he did these things like give women the right to drive, make some, you know, nice noises about promoting a different sort of flavor of Islam. And instead of looking at it and saying, well, wait a second, he's also actually imprisoning these women activists at the same time. And he's saying to the kingdom, this is a gift from me. And it's not like a reform in the sense of we're going to have a little bit more of a accountable to the polity. It's just that I'm an enlightened young prince and you're going to thank me for this. That the Western press and media was so lost in their own projections of, you know, privatizing the oil industry in Saudi Arabia, or even just, or even these things that they're right about, like the need for women to drive, but not looking into more systemic questions about how power actually works there, that this guy was able to make a splashy good impression here really very easily, even as who he is was already even reported in a place like The New Yorker by Dexter Filkins, right? Like, you didn't have to search that far and wide.
I think that's fairly close to what has happened. But I will point out, it's not just a function of MBS and him being the young prince. Every Saudi ruler who has come to power, the New York Times has declared to be a reformer. King Abdullah was declared a reformer. Before him, Fahd was declared a reformer. Faisal was declared a reformer. All these people have been declared by the newspapers of record in the West to be reformers. With Mohammed bin Salman, I think it was accentuated because when he came to power, and of course he's not the king yet, but we know that he will be. But when he came to power, he wasn't already half dead. Like many of the other Saudi leaders, he pressed every button that there was. Women, allowing women to drive, providing opportunity for women to be in the workforce more openly, theaters, sporting events, reining in the religious police was perhaps the most important thing for him to do. That was deeply appealing to people looking at Saudi Arabia from the West, or among Saudis themselves, that they deeply hated religious police. These things built were intended to build a domestic constituency for Mohammed bin Salman, so that when he did try to take on those within the royal family who were opposed to his rise and opposed to his plans, he would have this reservoir of support. And I'll tell you, I spent 2 weeks in Saudi Arabia around this time last year, and I purposely avoided talking to elites about Mohammed bin Salman. In fact, there were virtually no elites on my itinerary. And kind of the powerless Saudis really did have high hopes for him. Now, you could say, well, you know, look, Saudis like their leaders and so on and so forth. I'd like to give Saudis a little more credit than that. So I think that they did think that there was something new here. I think things that have happened since that time, one can imagine people are questioning all the wisdom of the Crown Prince. And I will say, even at that time, people did question the wisdom of being at war in Yemen, given the real tight connections between those two countries. But you're quite right when it comes to the West. I mean, he was in the United States in March, April of 2018, and he was received like a rock star, And it was, quite frankly, it was bizarre. Given who he is, given the fact that even his, you know, grand plan for reform, first of all, big parts of this were nothing new. I'm old enough that I remember two previous grand plans for reform in Saudi Arabia. Second, what he was trying to do was, you know, deeply destabilizing to Saudi Arabia. And I think people kind of lost sight of it because, oh, he's outward looking. Meanwhile, this is a guy who'd never really been outside of Saudi Arabia. And that's one of the reasons why he was the anointed one by his father, who is the family enforcer. And we know that apples don't fall that far from the tree, even if the sun is deny it. So, I think it's a big, as much as there's been, you know, as the Secretary of State has said, there's been a media pile on now to be critical of Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. I think at the time there was this kind of media kind of exhilaration around this guy and what he was likely, or what they imputed to him, what he might do.
Right. And I think, and I really underline just the total omission of the grassroots energy for of things like women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia that were totally obscured in that conversation.
Right.
Of like, oh my God, look at how cool this guy is. And of course that it fits into a much longer pattern, as you said, of these relationships. And, you know, that was another, I mean, that's another funding source of Tony Blair's Institute that's been revealed recently. Like, some of this stuff is just, yes.
Right. There is that aspect of it as well. Right. Of course.
What though? Okay. So your piece in Foreign Policy, Mohammed bin Salman is worse than a criminal. He's a symbol. You're focusing in that piece though, about how, and, you know, set it up for us in terms of the Khashoggi murder and the bigger fault lines that that's starting to open up. And you can talk about that, but then we'll pivot to, you know, the interference being run by, for him by Kushner, Trump, and Pompeo.
Right. Well, you know, I've been writing about the Saudis quite a bit, not just as a result of the Khashoggi murder, but, you know, my real kind of uptick in writing about Saudis, it started actually with his emergence and his Vision 2030, but really over the summer, before Khashoggi was murdered, the freak out over Canada was something that really that fascinated me. Like, why, if this guy is such a reformer and he's so forward leaning and he's changing the culture in Saudi Arabia, would he be freaking out about some mild criticism from Canada? And I think it really reveals what he and his entourage were like. That, you know, obviously we didn't know at the time that he freaked out at Canada. At the time he was freaking out at Canada over a tweet that that he was actually targeting Jamal Khashoggi and others like him. And the Saudis, it's really interesting. They have been, when you listen to them, when you listen to Saudis in the United States, they have a completely opposite perspective on the way in which Mohammed bin Salman was received initially in the United States. They think he's never gotten any good press. The Saudis never get a break. Wow. They're such good allies. They're criticized relentlessly. And then this only proves the murder of Khashoggi and what Secretary Pompeo called caterwauling on the Hill. And as I said before, a media pylon. This just proves that the American elite, the media, is reflexively opposed to Saudi Arabia. And so this piece was really actually focused on explaining to Saudis why Americans would be so outraged over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, especially since, you know, how many people knew the name Jamal Khashoggi before October 2nd, 2018? But as I point out, you know, the place they go and pick up my bagel, these guys, you know, they're like, what's up with the Khashoggi thing?
Right.
You know, my mom's bridge club. People, like, they recoil at this. And so the point of the piece was to say, it's not caterwauling. It's not a media pylon. There are some real issues at stake here. And that's the symbol part. So, you know, I pointed out first, even though there's bipartisan support for some of the stuff going on Capitol Hill, there is a partisan effort given the close connection between the Trump family and Mohammed bin Salman. Second, look, this is unfinished business related to 9/11. I think it's undeniable that people have started a gun sweeping really bad Saudi behavior under the rug. And the fact that, you know, the Saudis got really angry at me for bringing this up. But my answer to them is, look, if there are parts of not the 9/11 report that have not been made public, and they have not been made public, in large part because you don't want it to make it raises suspicions about what your actual role was in those attacks. And then I think the other things are Mohammed bin Salman has come to symbolize a world that is out of control. Look, if you are a journalist these days, and I'm tempted to say if you're an international correspondent, but of course there's a connection to the domestic politics here. You have to live in abject terror of what might happen to you if you cross somebody's red line that you have no idea that you've crossed their red line. Even for someone like myself, an analyst with an academic training, to go abroad these days is a very scary prospect. So yeah. It's a world where there are no norms, things are out of control, and Mohammed bin Salman has come to really symbolize that. And again, I was trying to explain this to Saudis and just the onslaught of criticism that I've gotten from Saudis for trying to explain to them American outrage over what happened. It's really hard.
Okay, so that kind of blows my mind. I mean, I have some bigger questions about it, but like whatever one thinks of the Saudis, and obviously we're talking essentially about their elites, their leadership, not everyday Saudis. But like, even if you're a very fierce critic of the Saudi monarchy, which, you know, kind of, I mean, I am. I guess what I'm saying is the fact that it never, I mean, these people are still in general very sophisticated, very capable of operating in a lot of different contexts. They didn't think that abducting a Washington Post journalist and hacking him alive with a bone saw would freak people out. I mean, even if they calculated correctly that the Trump administration would cover for them, which is the accurate assessment, they didn't think that this, I mean, I mean, that actually is awe-inspiring that they didn't think that this would bother people and freak people
right out. I think that it's a function of a couple of things. One, and they're connected, and this may sound banal, but you know, the Saudis haven't had an effective ambassador in Washington D.C. in 3 or 4 years since the now foreign minister Adel Joubert departed. So there's no real flow of information about the way in which Washington works going to Riyadh. Secondly, you know, Mohammed bin Salman, not worldly, unlike a lot of other Saudi elites, was not educated abroad. The people around him, his closest advisors, the same thing. And they have become insulated by their own kind of view of the world that is impenetrable. And so, yeah, he's a journalist. He has offended the Saudi Arabia and offended its leader. And this is the way they were going to go about handling it. And I think from all reports, I think one of the few Washington D.C. Middle East analysts who's actually never met Mohammed bin Salman. But all reports are that he's been stunned by the reaction, which is absolutely, as you point out, absolutely stunning. That not only in the stupidity of this operation, but just the idea that, we can murder a journalist and it would go unnoticed. I think that happens a lot, but a number of things have come together to make it a focal point for the way in which for the world that we live in, and a focal point for Americans who are tired, as I said before, of sweeping bad Saudi behavior under the rug. I think they're totally unaware. Think of everything that we've learned about Mohammed bin Salman and his advisors since the Khashoggi story broke. These guys are isolated. They look at the world. They have this puffed up way. Saudi Arabia is as important as, you know, look, the Russians get away with stuff. The Turks get away with stuff. The Israelis get away with stuff. Right. They're killing people. We're going to eliminate our enemies as well. Without understanding, one, they're not those countries. Two, there are nuances and complexities of their position in the world that makes it that runs against their analysis that they could get away with it like those other countries.
I mean, I'm all for the project of Khashoggi should be a door to a much wider critique. You know, why? Okay, I think it's a totally valid criticism. You know, Lindsey Graham has a big meltdown about Khashoggi, but has been until very recently, very supportive of any kind of Saudi atrocity possible.
Right.
There's a whole larger set of questions that are valid and vital and important. And then conversely, people that want to minimize the resetting of the template of what is acceptable and the new dangers that it opens, that, you know, of abducting a journalist like that. I mean, I think the closest I could think of was when the, you know, U.S.-backed Chilean regime in the 70s planted a car bomb on a, you know, former diplomat
right.
in D.C. And certainly
right.
Kissinger helped cover it up for him. That's a matter of public record. But I also have no doubt that there were back channels that said, hey, we're going to run interference while you guys kill a ton of people in Chile, but you can't bring that here. Now, obviously, I don't want either thing to happen, but it's still a vast escalation, or not a moral vast escalation, but a escalation in terms of where and of extremes you're operating in and conventions you're overturning to do something like take a Washington Post columnist in a Istanbul embassy and cut him alive with a hacksaw. I mean, it's just, I can't, I'm genuinely stunned because I don't think of the Saudis as dumb, right? Like I have problems, but I don't think of them as stupid. Yeah.
So, and look, as soon as Jamal Khashoggi went missing, I kind of reached out to friends in Saudi and in the Gulf. And I said, what's going on? And I said, we can't imagine what's going on, but we know the Saudis aren't this stupid to have done this.
Right.
And you know, so no one could imagine that. And so this was, again, it's a new leadership. And, you know, defenders, people who wanted to go away, who went to sweep it on the right, say, well, he's young, he's inexperienced, and so, come on.
I mean, look, he's like, you're the drugs you did. Play. That's not,
right.
He's young, he's inexperienced, exactly. He ordered a journalist to be hacked alive.
Right, that's like what, you know, that was like the excuse, you know, I was trying to defend myself, like when I took the car out when I was 15. Well, I'm young, I'm inexperienced, you know. Right, this guy's out getting, having journalists eliminated.
This is the large adult son phenomenon.
Large adult son phenomenon, right. Exactly.
So it is stunning that they think that when they did it, that they think they could get away with it, and that they are offended by the outrage, associated with it. And of course, you do have the Trump administration running heavy interference.
Well, I want to get to that in a sec. Can I set that for you? Because I want to just bring one other thing into it. So I do want to get to the Trump administration. And I do think maybe we should be shopping around a Will Ferrell vehicle where he plays MBS, but that's a conversation for another day. I could see that.
Oh my God.
Saudi,
too soon. Yeah. Too soon, I think.
Saudi stepbrothers. I'm just going to assert it. I won't be going in any Saudi embassies anytime soon. There's a new piece in the Daily Beast that says, get ready for the Mueller's phase two, the Middle East connection.
Oh yeah.
Now
I
have to be honest. I remain pretty agnostic about the Russia investigation in the sense, I think there's certainly a there, and we'll see whether it's this all encompassing thing that some people imagine it to be, or if it's just a more sort of like, you know, problematic, but yes, there's all sorts of influence peddling. And some of that might be from, you know, the Koch brothers or the Russians or whoever. But it does seem to me that as far as what is already on the public record, we actually could document a very clear relationships of compromise and pretty clear quid pro quo, as far as I can make out, in relationships between the Trump administration and the Saudis and the Emiratis. So how is that? I mean, maybe put that in context for the sort of running interference for MBS.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely, I think the great, and my eyebrows raised when I saw that in the Daily Beast today, because it is the great underreported story of the 2016 cycle that, you know, look, the Gulf countries the Saudis, Emiratis in particular, Bahrainis as well, the Israelis, there's an Israeli angle to this as well, outraged by the Obama administration's policies in the region, fearful that a Clinton administration would continue those policies in some in some form, understanding that the Trump people were going to be very, very tough on the Iranians, and clearly preferred what Trump was offering over over Secretary Clinton. And there's been, you know, these documented cases of RNC finance chair Elliot Broidy, a guy named George Nader, who at one time published this little niche magazine in Washington, D.C., and then became this international kind of broker of influence peddling in the Middle East. These guys were deeply involved with the Emiratis and the Saudis and the Trump administration. In fact, it was even the Saudis, though, sent George Nader and Elliot Broidy packing. They didn't want to have anything to do with them, but the Emiratis were willing to play in that game. In coming in and out of the story with the Saudis and the Emiratis are actually a variety of Israeli businessmen who are also brokering contacts amongst all of these figures connected to Trump and Gulf countries. So I think there's a lot there for Mueller to investigate. And, you know, look, once the president came to office, it was actually pretty easy for the Gulf countries in particular to do the kind of business that they've been doing with the Trump administration, political business or otherwise, because, you know, the president's son-in-law signaled very early on by handing out his cell phone number to people that there is that the formal policy process, the way in which these countries dealt with the United States previously, and I'm not saying that, you know, people didn't have, you know, high-level officials in the Obama administration cell phone numbers or their private email addresses, but Kushner signaled that you could ignore the policy process and goes directly to him. And this kind of informal way of doing politics really kind of aligns quite well with the political culture in a lot of these countries. And so they took full advantage of this, full advantage.
Kind of like the, yeah, like, hey, just go to this restaurant. Like, we're having tea. Let's just talk. We'll figure out a parallel track.
Right. Or, hey, we don't like what the president's saying about the Qataris. Jared, you know, here's the real deal. Here's what you should know.
Well, that's another thing that I wanted to, I mean, we'll get to Turkey in a second. I know we only have a few more minutes, but this is important because that's a whole other underreported, but really, I mean, you know, it's not this belligerence towards Iran and undermining of what was a very successful, whatever else you say about Iran, the Iran deal was an incredible success and a net positive for the world. It's not this, you know, belligerence from a right-wing Israeli government, which like, Ehud Olmert, now fresh out of prison, is saying, like, hey, like, guys, we're not under threat. Like, you keep saying we're under threat. That's just objectively not true.
Right?
And he's absolutely right. And so it doesn't make as much news because they have, you know, their own massive wealth and their own sort of, you know, they're getting, actually, maybe this does bring us to Turkey because they're getting support from the Turks. But, you know, the embargo, the Qatari blockade, that's a mind-blowing action that they would do that even within the context of the Gulf Cooperation Council. And the fact that they could pick off the Kushners and the Trumps from just like the U.S. Central Commands, who would be like, dude, we actually like, we use that place.
And this is, it's a perfect example of the way in which they took full advantage of it. You know, the president's initial response to the embargo was, you know, first to tweet that the, you know, nasty stuff about the Qataris, and then to, you know, advise the Emiratis and the Saudis to continue to squeeze the Qataris. It raised questions in people's minds whether the president was actually even aware that CENTCOM Forward, Al Udeid Air Base, was located in Qatar. It seems that he was completely unaware that this was the place from which the United States conducted its military operations.
I'm going to go with he didn't know. I'm going to go with he didn't know.
It was the place where if there was going to be a confrontation from Iran, it was going to be executed from this place. It boggles the mind. You're right. I mean, I think the reasonable thing to believe is that he was completely unaware of this. And since then, it's not long thereafter, you know, until Mattis could get to a telephone, I guess. Then, you know, the kind of the presidential statements about the blockade changed. And there was some effort over the summer of 2018 to try to bring it to an end by the president bringing pressure to bear on the Saudis and the Emiratis, but they just basically ignored him.
And I would just also say, we're going to get final question in Turkey in just a second, but look up Qataris, Kushner, and 666 Broadway.
Right.
That is a whole other dimension of, oh, you're not going to help bail me out of this disastrously stupid real estate investment? Maybe I'll be less helpful with my father-in-law when the Saudis blockade you. And that is literally the level of policy we're talking about here.
Can we just turn it back to MBS for a second?
Yes,
you
please.
Know that he and his guys they want to build essentially a moat around Qatar. You know, Qatar is connected to the Arabian Peninsula.
Right.
They want to dig, essentially to cut it off. I mean, this is kind of crazy. This is the craziness that's going on there. This is the craziness with this blockade of the countries. Look, the countries are no angels by any
sure.
stretch of imagination. They've perfected playing it out of both sides of their mouth.
Sure.
But this is a fantastic failure on the part of the Saudis and the Emiratis to blockade the Qataris and to believe that they could do it from the get-go, given the enormous investment the United States has in ensuring that we continue to use that base in Doha.
Just briefly on Turkey, your new piece, I'm sick. I'm sick of Turkey. Washington yeah. continues to claim Ankara as a strategic partner. Let's stop pretending it is. It strikes me just as Via's setup, and you can explain that in a second. But is it fair to say that if Erdogan was not Muslim, he would be a perfect fit for this global far-right Trump, Bolsonaro, Putin, Orban, Modi? In some respects, he was kind of he changed from like George W. Bush to alt-right Muslim before these other people even took office. And
yeah, he was. There really yeah. is a Turkish model, and he
yeah.
was it.
Yeah,
I'd say that is fairly close to what's happened. Is you know, Erdogan has been a leader of this kind of new wave of authoritarianism around the world. Obviously, you know, a lot of these guys discovered it on their own, but certainly he fits in that category, which is a reversal. You know, 15 years ago, people believed that Erdogan was going to, you know, bring Turkey into the European Union. You know, the ultimate club of liberal democracies, although we now have a number of members who are just like Erdogan. I think the reason why, you know, the why I'm sick of Turkey was my annual kind of rant on Thanksgiving Day for Politico, in which I use all kinds of, you know, puns and things to kind of connect Thanksgiving dinner to the country Turkey, which really annoys the Turks to no end. And I can understand it, but I also can't resist being snarky. And I think the point that I'm trying to make about Turkey is that the foreign policy establishment for a really long time has romanticized the relationship between the United States and Turkey, that we stood shoulder to shoulder during the Cold War and that we fought and died together in the Korean War. And Turkey is just important. And therefore it is a strategic partner in the United States. But if you look at the evidence, Erdogan has, undermined American efforts over the last 8 years, at least. Now, the relationship was never perfect, but the Turks see themselves as a great power and want to have a foreign policy independent of the United States and they want to be considered to be a great power in its own right. That is their right. And I think that what's happened between the United States and Turkey is, I think, separate from either Recep Tayyip Erdogan or Donald Trump. I think it's really a structural problem, and the countries are moving in different directions. My call in that piece, as well as a more sober piece that I wrote for the Council on Foreign Relations, called Neither Friend Nor Foe, The Future of U.S.-Turkey Relations, is for us to recognize that there's no saving of some mythical strategic relationship, but that Turkey is a country that has its own interests. Oftentimes those interests clash with American interests. That doesn't mean that we won't be able to cooperate with them on certain discrete areas. But for the most part, Turkey is among a number of countries who want to change the rules of the game in the region around it that have for the better part of the last five decades been written by the United States.
Well, there you have it. And that will be the source of many future conversations between us. But I incredibly appreciate this tour. Stephen A. Cook, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, co-host of Amen Corner. Steve, thanks a million as always.
Michael, always a pleasure.
Thanks, man. Talk to you soon.
See you. Bye.
All right, folks. Look up 666 Broadway, Qatar, Jared Kushner. I mean, the long and short of it is that Jared Kushner sunk a lot of his family's money into a prime piece of Manhattan real estate at exactly the wrong time to do it, and pitched to the Qataris. The Qataris have a massive sovereign wealth fund from oil, and they were in town looking for some investment properties, and Kushner pitched them helping out on the building. And they made the wise financial decision, but probably the not wise political decision to not give the kid some money. And then not too much there long after that, the United States and Trump at first is sending positive signals for this reckless, insane blockade that the Saudis put, and they still have put, on the Emiratis. So another good example of how the world works that I would check out. We got to get to the fun half, where we are going to have plenty of fun, plenty of dunking. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Pennies a day makes this show possible, so we are accountable to you. Over 90% of this show's funds come from its members. If you haven't yet, hit the subscribe button on YouTube. Keep spreading the Majority Report message. Subscribe on iTunes, write a review. JustCoffee.coop. Is JustCoffee.coop? It has a major deal going on through the holidays, and you can find a link to it on the Majority.fm homepage, where you can also get one of literally dozens rapidly decreasing supply of tickets to our January 13th, right? 13th?
Yep.
January 13th live show. Come see us at the Bell House. And then while you're there, you can also click over and get your tickets to also the rapidly selling Michael Brooks live show at February 1st on the Bell House as well. With special guests, Ilona Minkowski, Bhaskar Sunkara, Trevor Beaulieu. This Sunday, for TMBS patrons, Elizabeth Brunig and I did an illicit history of Beto O'Rourke, starting a new series of illicit histories of 2020 presidential contenders, a user's guide. On Tuesday, Julian Assange, Facebook, The Future of Press with Matt Taibbi, plus a deep dive into Macron on TMBS. If you haven't yet, go over to the TMBS YouTube channel, where there's a lot of clips now, and you can stream the show live. And also, of course, on iTunes, you can subscribe. And patreon.com/TMBS, get the whole thing. Matt, what's going on with Literary Hangover?
Did my episode on Nancy McLean's Democracy in Chains.
It was good.
So check that out. If you were interested in that book and you got skittish because of the onslaught of criticism, we kind of discussed that. If you didn't hear the onslaught of criticism, still a book to check out.
I totally stand by my support of that book.
Yep,
I think too. People definitely ought to read that book. It's very important. for understanding the context of how the right operates.
It's a hyper-concentrated, very well-written book. Some would say too concentrated. I wouldn't. Of the sort of alliances made in Capital's fight against democracy.
Check out Jamie's show, The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada for all of that content as well. We're going to go to the fun half. See you.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back.